You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
Here's a very quick apology before I continue the episode. As a chronically ill and disabled person, there is sometimes going to be a risk that not everything goes to plan. I'd told Maz before we recorded this episode that I had incredibly bad brain fog. And by the end of it, I was overjoyed that I'd managed to pretty much get away without anything going wrong as a result. However, when I came to listen back to it, I realised that instead of plugging my microphone in, I'd plugged in my ring light instead. So my audio quality is terrible, but Maz sounds fantastic, which is all that matters, really, right? So apologies in advance, and do please listen to it because it's such a fantastic interview and Maz is amazing. Welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities, an inclusive podcast focused on queer, disabled and marginalised creatives and their art. You can now support the show by becoming a patron on Patreon. For as little as £1 a month, you can get early access to shows, exclusive content and a shout out to say thank you. To find out more, visit patreon.com/agparker. On that note, here's a huge shout out to my two new patrons, Andrew Gerzer and Phil Anderson. Thank you both so much for sponsoring this podcast. It means the world. And now, on with the show. Welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities, Maz Hedgehog. How are you?
I'm really good today. I'm doing good. I'm in a good mood today.
That's fantastic. So you're the second person I've had on the podcast this week. I mean, obviously, it's not going to work out like that when it comes out. But the second person who said that they are fantastic and they're doing really well. This is brilliant.
Oh, fabulous. Like, there's something in the air, obviously. I think people can sense that spring is coming. The sun's out.
Yes.
And so it's just everything's a little bit less bleak.
Indeed. I've seen daffodils around and some crocuses, and that certainly helps cheer the spirit a bit.
Yeah.
So, Maz, before we get into it, because I really want to talk about your book that is coming out, I'm very excited. Tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Okay, so I'm Maz Hedgehog. I am, I guess the shorthand would be writer and performer. I work kind of in poetry and theatre mostly. I have a couple of books. So, alongside The Body in Its Season that we're talking about today, my first chapbook, with Regina, came out just over 3 years ago now. It is a little poetry chapbook charting the rise and fall of a fairy queen. And then last year, I edited a poetry anthology with Three of Cups Press called Tell Me Who We Were Before Life Made Us. And that is really an anthology about imagined history, so about myths and legends and the stories that we tell ourselves and why we tell them. So I have a lot of fun doing that. It's my first time editing an anthology. And then performance-wise, I have a solo show called Let Me Count the Ways. And that is like an hour-long spoken word show about healing and love and boundaries and all that good stuff. And I'm based in Manchester in England, if that's also helpful, so working in and around the Northwest. And I kind of do bits and pieces of writing or performing or acting here or there, I think that about summarizes it.
so many things, and actually I've got questions about all your different art across all these different mediums, because I did a bit of stalking in preparation for this podcast, and oh my god, I was absolutely blown away by all the different things that you've got out there. But let's just jump straight in. Your new book is out, or it's coming out. I've got a copy, I know that much, and it's fantastic. But is it out for public sale yet?
Not yet. It is published next month, but you can pre-order copies from my website, mazhedgehog.com. And all the pre-order copies are signed. I've also got a little launch box, and it comes with The Body in Its Seasons, a bonus pamphlet called Aurora and Her Sire, but then have a cover that's been done by the wonderful Ray Carter, and get like a, you know, a bookmark and a postcard and some tea, all wrapped up in a lovely bright blue box.
That literally sounds so perfect. We're on the cusp of spring, but it's still quite cold. So I can imagine sitting down in an armchair with a nice pot of tea and those books. It's just fantastic. It's published by Burning Eye Books. So you can also pre-order it from their website as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And you describe it as an experimental novel / poetry collection about obsession and depression and Black queer divinities. And yeah, it's absolutely delicious. So it felt like a retelling of the old wisdoms. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but, you know, like Angela Carter, Clarissa Pinkola Estes, N.K. Jemisin, Neil Gaiman, they've kind of taken law and put a modern twist on it, or like actually you're reimagining or creating law from cosmic dust, and it's beautiful.
Thank you so much. Like, this, honestly, it's... you know, I guess this is a book that has been in many ways kind of a long time coming, and it's kind of been bouncing between me and my editor and a couple of first readers for ages. And you never know how something that's this odd is going to be received. So knowing how much you enjoyed, like, honestly makes me really, really happy. So thank you so much.
No, it's really wonderful. It's incredibly powerful, and also I think really healing to read. It is in the same vein as kind of sitting down with like a spiritual self-help book, almost that kind of style. But then, as you say, yeah, it's weird and wonderful. You can't put it into any particular category. Please tell me about the inspiration. How did it come into being?
So the journey of this is a bit of a weird one. So the current form that it's in really came together in about 6 months last year, but the pieces in there have had a much longer history. So I think the oldest poem in there will probably be The Moon, and I wrote that in 2017. That's a good, like, 5 years old. And, you know, as I finished Viva Regina, I noodled around with other chapbooks, but none of them really excited me that much. And so I decided, you know what, I think 2019, I think. I decided, like, you know what, I have, you know, years of poems.
Yeah.
Why don't I try and write a full collection? And so I did that. I think I had what I thought was a full collection together in about 6 months. Started sending it out places and got exactly nowhere. At that point, also a fairly classic poetry collection. So just kind of a lot of poems put together at the time, actually not collected together very well, yeah. Didn't have a ton of structure. And I took it back and reworked it. And, you know, I wrote the body, the first piece in the book during the pandemic, right towards the beginning, actually. And, you know, like, okay, right, this is actually a really bold opening salvo for a collection.
Yeah.
So, I then, you know, wrote again, selected about half a dozen poems, and sent it to Burning Eye with this proposal. And it was still at that point a fairly classic poetry collection. So I think it was probably about last February, Burning Eye were like, yeah, totally, come on board. And at that point, I knew that I wasn't ready for this book to hit the public. Like, I wasn't ready for people to read it. I knew it needed work. I didn't know what work it needed.
Yeah.
So I reached out to the guy who edited my chapbook, Adam Lowe, because, you know, I really enjoyed working with him before, and he really understands it, like, you know, what I'm trying to do with my work.
Mm.
And then when I sent the manuscript to him, he was like, make it bonkers. Just, I know you need a frame, you need to do something interesting with form, you need to have something you can really sink your teeth into. Take the idea that you don't think you're good enough to write and write it. And so basically, literally over the course of about 6 months, I thought of doing something that's obviously quite high level and quite conceptual about humoral theory and medieval medicine. And then I scrapped that idea because it would have required too much research and I wanted to get it done.
Fair enough, yeah.
And throughout the process, you know, Maddie came to me and kind of unfolded herself as I was, you know, trying, because like having a narrative and footnote, you always go kind of the moment Adam said go bonkers, I was like, footnotes, I love footnotes, give me footnotes.
Yeah, oh my God.
And footnote. So I was, yeah, you know, I was commenting, I was writing these commentary on the poems, and through that, you know, Maddie kind of emerged from the marginalia.
Yeah.
And as I got to know her better and write her and write around her and figure out who she is, you know, and as Adam pushed me and pushed me and pushed me to kind of dig deeper and go further and be more daring, the book came together, and I think I finished it and sent it off for copy editing last September. So I think it'll be here for March, September is when combination of like a two, three year process. And it's when this book really found its identity.
And it is all about identity. It's an exploration of the self, isn't it? And it's absolutely stunning. And that, so, God, I've got so many things, like everything you say, I'm like, oh my God, I want to pick up on that. I'm going to have to pace myself, or all the questions are going to come out at once. First off, I'm so excited for you that you had an editor that was willing to kind of, who knew who you were as a creator and how they could get, you know, what you needed to come out. And I think that's just fantastic that you had that support and that person pushing you to do the weird stuff.
Yeah, you know, like before I did Be About Regina, I'd never been edited before. Not really. And then having Adam, who, you know, saw it and was really kind but very firm and wouldn't let me be lazy. You know, be like, okay, what is this here to accomplish? Right now it just feels like filler, and I'd be like, oh, that's because it kind of is filler, because a chapbook needs to be about 30 pages and it only had 20 written. He was like, okay. All right. Yeah, no. You know, he gave me reading to do and research to do to be able to go away and make a better book. And it means that Be About Regina is something that I can stand behind and be proud of and still love.
Yeah.
You know, now 3 years later.
Wonderful.
With The Body in Its Seasons, again, it gave me that push and the permission to be as weird and as wonderful as I want it to be.
And I think that has to be the dream for so many creatives, is to find somebody to have in your life that does that for you and that does that for your work. You know, so many people say, well, there's no kind of magical wand that someone will wave that gives you permission to feel like you are a creative, like you are an artist, like you're good enough to do all the things. But having someone in your corner just to say, yeah, I love your weird, do more of it, it goes a huge way to actually getting someone's work out there. So I'm 100%. so fucking happy that Adam was in your life, because, oh my God, this book. so the first piece, The Body, that wasn't the cornerstone of the collection. It wasn't in there originally.
No. You know, I think kind of this collection had so many iterations and had so many different structures and forms. The body only, you know, it only came into existence in like late spring, early summer 2020. But the moment that I wrote it, it was like, okay, no, this needs to be in the collection. And also this needs to be like the opening salvo.
Yeah.
So it felt like kind of a distillation of so much stuff that I've been writing around for years. And it feels like in a lot of ways, a lot of the writing that I'd done was almost culminating towards that one piece. And so, yeah, kind of whilst initially it wasn't the corner, the moment I wrote, the moment I'd finished it and it had, you know, and it existed, it was like, no, this is something that's really special.
Yeah.
And for any fiction that I write, this has to be at the center of it. Because I think it says a lot about what I write and why I write and how I write.
Yeah. And it feels like it almost epitomizes the rest of the collection, and it's so deeply kind of biblical in style.
Yes, that is 100% deliberate.
I mean that as a compliment, yeah. And then, but then you go straight from the body into in Timothy King's office, which I think is just one of the most fucking fantastic and head-spinning changes of genre and style and theme. And it just sets the reader up. Like, this, those kind of first few pages really grab us by the hand and bring us in. And that was it. I was hooked after those. I mean, what is that, like 7 pages, 5 pages? So, no, wonderful.
Thank you.
I want to quickly touch on genre with you because this whole book just two fingers up to genre, or is it a smorgasbord of genre? But there's a line from one of the pieces in here, Nameless, which is, she is not such a fan of names anyway. To name a thing is to restrict it. To name a thing is to tell it what it cannot be, which is so poignant, but I feel it also describes to some extent the blending of styles in your work in this collection.
Yeah, I mean, I love Nameless because kind of Nameless was one of those pieces that I didn't know was about Maddie when I wrote it. I didn't know because Maddie didn't really exist at that point. But when she emerged from the marginalia, it was like, oh, this poem is about her. But yeah, in terms of genre, you know, I am, as a reader, a lover of genre. I grew up on fantasy and science fiction.
Yes.
You know, I had a lot of time reading campy, mediocre 80s and 90s epic fantasy. Fantastic. In my preteens. There was a period of my life where I would not read anything that did not have did not involve a dragon, a witch, or a teenage girl wielding a giant sword.
Yes, please.
And, you know, and then I read a lot of Agatha Christie and that kind of realm of like locked door mysteries. And then, you know, at the minute I am a dedicated romance reader.
Okay.
And so, and alongside this comes my lifelong love of myth and folklore and fairy tales. You know, I was that weird kid who loved the really gruesome fairy tales, the bloodier the better.
Oh yes, please.
And so I love genre a lot, but I've never been much good at it because I tried to stick to any one genre convention and my brain goes spinning off into 8 other directions.
Yeah.
And so my approach is kind of, I think I learned a lot from reading Nalo Hopkinson and the way that her books blend genre and are less bound by genre convention than they are by whatever the story needs, like whatever the story needs to do.
Yeah.
So she will draw on whatever genre. And so with this book, it was like, okay, I know that I'm not going to do, if I try to do any one genre, it's going to fail visibly. So I will let each piece almost stands on its own and do whatever it needs to do to move this narrative and move this, you know, great image along.
Yeah. And I think obviously it absolutely you've nailed that. There's a Neil Gaiman quote. I feel like every episode I quote Neil Gaiman. There's a Neil Gaiman quote when he's talking about writing and genre, and he says something like, you have to learn the rules and then you can break them. And I feel like you've got this really amazing awareness of all the different styles, all the different genres, and you've used that to actually give each piece what it needs to be fully expressed.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, I think some people, there are some writers who find genre constricting, and I guess in some ways I'm one of them in that I'm just not good at it. But I love the way that genre, kind of especially once you're familiar with a genre, you can build an entire mood and atmosphere doing very little.
Yeah.
You know, the moment, if I open a book and it says, you know, Gawain is an 11-year-old boy who's kind of scrawny, the youngest of 7 brothers, and he's on a farm, and then a dragon flies overhead. I'm like, okay, cool. Gawain's the chosen one. He's going to have a ragtag bunch of friends, find the magic MacGuffin, and save the world from evil.
Absolutely.
I know how this goes. But, you know, the best in genre, of which Neil Gaiman is undoubtedly one of them, is his ability to kind of to use language and do a lot with very little and be able to reference, you know, different ideas and different moods and different conventions so that somebody who is new to the genre can like enjoy it.
Yeah.
But an old hand can be like, oh, I see what you're doing.
Exactly. I recognize this trope. Okay. You know, I know where.
Yeah. And I think kind of with each piece, you know, so with, you know, Brick Hollow,
Oh my God, yeah.
So, you know, Brick Hollow is a, you know, it's a kind of a spin on the portal fantasy almost in a way. In on the fairy story of the child who ends up in fairy. And, you know, having read thousands of those stories, I wanted to be able to create that. And I think Brick Hollow is only about 1,500 words. Mm. And doing that kind of across the book is just been a fun challenge for me.
You had me screaming when they sit down and he offers her food. And I'm like, oh my God, no, you're in fairy, don't eat the fruit. Just, and then, yeah, it's beautiful. You didn't have to explain anything. But I think, as you say, those who don't know the genre particularly well are going to enjoy it. But those who do are going to go, oh God, I can see that. And then there's that tension created, which was just really wonderful. Was that intentional or am I like reading too much into it?
No, yeah, and that's the thing, you know, because again, like Brick Hollow is one that I wrote actually using a prompt that a friend gave me. He's C.B. Blanchard. He is a dark fantasy horror writer himself. He has really beautiful work. And he kind of, you know, we were like doing some writing exercises together and gave me this prompt. And out of it, I wanted to tell a kind of what is in some ways a fairy kidnap story, but also for one that's for a little girl who wants to go.
Yeah.
You know, where there's not very much keeping her in the human world, at least not at this moment in time. Like in, from my mind, you know, Chia Gozie in Brick Hollow is a lot like Maddie was when she was that age. And I imagine that if somebody had given Maddie a chance to run away from her life when she was 10, would have taken it. Gave a chance, you know, now in her mid late 20s, and she ran away from her life for nearly a year. And then, yeah, that's what I wanted to do with Brick Hollow. And so I'm glad it worked.
It absolutely did. It was so wonderful. And then I couldn't help but draw comparisons between Brick Hollow and I can't remember the name of it, but there's an audio drama in which there was a woman with a magical mistress who called her on the phone.
Yes, this is Mirror. It definitely exists in the same universe in my head. And I wrote, Mirror has had about 8 different iterations at various points over the past few years. But I'll actually explain what it is. So Mirror is an audio drama that I wrote and created with support from New Creatives North, which is a scheme that kind of supports like emerging writers to make work either for audio, they also do some short films, and they also do like multimedia immersive installations. So I did an audio drama that is about a young woman who was kidnapped by fairies as a child, escaped later on, but hasn't really escaped. And her fairy mistress keeps calling her because our main character has nightmares, has most horrendous nightmares, and only her fairy mistress can alleviate them. And so it's basically the choice between, do you choose freedom or do you choose rest? And what that choice means. So, you know, Brick Hollow, I think for me also emerges from the same question.
Yeah.
Where for Chia Gozie, it's, do you choose fun and play and diversion, or do you choose reality with all that entails? And maybe because she's a child and Michigo is only about 10 years old, it's an unfair question, an unfair decision to ask her to make, but it's still one that she has to make fundamentally.
And I think it kind of brings a sense of yearning to us as a reader. I'm 32 and like the yearning I had reading Brick Hollow and listening to Mirror was so powerful. Mirror is so chilling and so beautiful at the same time. So I absolutely adored it.
Thank you.
And yeah, as you say, there's a lot of fantastical elements in your work across, I think, almost every medium. One of the pieces, every piece in the collection has got something magical or fantastical about it. But Anatomy really struck me because it was so ritualistic and then really profoundly healing as well. Can you tell me a little bit more about the inspiration behind that poem?
Yes. I mean, for me, actually, anatomy is kind of, if the body is the piece that is, you know, what I know, like the opening salvo, the one, anatomy is probably the piece that means the most to me, like it's the piece that I got the most out of writing. Mm. And, you know, a lot of my work is, I'm interested in bodies and how we interact with our bodies and how we experience the world through our bodies.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't read The Body Keeps the Score, but I love the title and it's kind of been buzzing around in my mind ever since I first heard it.
Yeah.
And with anatomy, it's like, okay, what, like, for the body keeps a score, in the most literal sense, what would that mean?
Yeah.
And what would it mean to try to undo that damage? And can you undo the damage, or do you have to just work through it?
Yeah.
And anatomy is, for me, is working through the damage. And specifically, it's Maddie working through her damage.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the one that I found deeply cathartic to write and wasn't sure how I was going to end the book. And I wasn't sure where Maddie would end up. But I think when I wrote anatomy, I was like, okay, I know how this goes. I know where this ends. And I know how to resolve this. And so I think it was a moment of writing where Maddie felt the most real to me.
Yeah. And I think it's got such a wonderful message that any reader can take on as well. And almost, it's almost like a blueprint as well for a practice that somebody can take away and do themselves. So I know for myself personally, and you hear it quite a lot, if you go to therapy, if you've had any sort of counselling, they'll say your body stores trauma.
Mm.
And this poem really spoke to that. And so after I read it, I went away and I was like, actually, this is probably a really good time to kind of sit here and go through my own body and kind of reestablish that connection with myself and what needs healing and how are we doing, you know, kind of checking in. And I just thought that was a really wonderful little piece of magic that people can do themselves.
Thank you. No, I think that's, you know, I mean, writing it was in many ways like, it was a way for me to love Maddie. And because God bless her, she's a hothouse mess. And I wanted to be able to love her and love her through.
Yeah.
And yeah, anatomy is that. And so I'm really glad because that has helped you think about ways to love your body a little bit better, because that's what I want for people. Maybe able to love themselves and love this meat vehicle we pilot through the world a little bit better.
Yeah. Cause so often we fight it either because it causes us pain and we think like, why are you doing this? Why can't you just do the things I want you to do? I know as a disabled person that's how I feel, but also we've got society's got a constant noise about what our bodies should look like, what they should be able to do, how they should perform. And so trying to drown that out, actually a lot of this collection just felt like drowning out a lot of noise that is toxic, that is harmful, and just saying, no, okay, I've had enough, and looking inward and saying, what is it I actually need?
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, this is a book that's been very much born of the pandemic and very much born of lockdowns, even though it's not really about that.
Mm.
But, you know, I wanted it to be a call to go inwards and to, you know, if you're one of those people who have been able to have more free time and have more space and have more unstructured time during the pandemic, then perhaps the kind of, I know that I use as a chance to take stock and to think about the life that I was living, about what I actually wanted versus what I felt as though I should want. And then kind of, I would love other people to be able to do the same. I know that that is not an easy or uncomplicated thing, and that what we want versus what we can actually have is something that's heavily mediated by power and privilege and politics.
Yeah.
But I would love for people to be able and to have the space and the time to even ask themselves that question.
Yeah.
Because so many people literally never get a chance, literally never have the breathing space to honestly ask the question and listen to what answer emerges.
Yeah. And I think anything that's going to create permission for people to do that is a really wonderful thing. And I think this collection does that.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you one more question. Well, probably one more question, maybe several more questions about the collection. with regards to genre, so you're non-binary, correct?
Yes.
Fantastic. Okay. So as a non-binary person, was it a conscious decision to have a blending of genre? Because it kind of almost feels representative of your experience itself, or was it just a happy coincidence?
My playing with and blending of genre and blending of form is never deliberate. I have a wonderful mentor in Greg Thorpe. He kind of does a lot of like producing and programming and stuff across the arts scene across Manchester. Mm-hmm. And he's been a wonderful champion of my work ever since he met Regina. And, you know, we met a little while ago and he, you know, he also asked me a similar question for a different project that I'm working on, that once again, you know, I am mixing and matching and blending forms. You know, do I deliberately queer form? And it's like, no, I don't do this on purpose. It just happens.
Wonderful.
You know, I do what makes the most sense to me.
Yeah.
And I do what I think the piece needs. And I try to kind of do take the quickest route to doing what it is I want to do.
Yeah.
And saying what it is I want to say. And I can pick up and put down whatever form works best and whatever genre works best to do that. I think in a lot of ways, I play with and blend with form naturally.
Uh-huh.
Being less generous, I am too lazy and non-committal to stick it out with any one form or genre long enough to see if it'll actually work. And just hop from, flip from one to the other like a drunk butterfly.
I fail to believe that. I feel like you prioritize the communication of the subject. I can't see you as a lazy writer. That just doesn't fit at all with all of your work. So
thank you. But no, yeah, it's just I think it'll be because I've never really gotten very much by way of formal training, you know. I just learned mostly by reading, attending a few workshops, being in community with other writers and learning from them.
Yeah.
And so I think it doesn't occur to me that I can't just do something if it makes sense. You know, if it doesn't fit rule and convention, especially with my background as a poet.
Yeah.
And poets do weird shit the time. And so it just doesn't really occur to me that I can't do the weird thing.
Yeah.
So I just do it and then figure out, you know, 6 weeks later, like, oh, I once again have accidentally made this impossible to market. Good for me.
Amazing. Yep, yep. Yeah, you always have to consider that marketability. But, I mean, do you?
I mean, that's what publishers are for, really.
Exactly. Like, you as an artist. Just, you know, as long as you create what needs to be created and you've got that authentic voice, which you do, I think that's the most important thing. God damn it, someone else can fix the genre, the marketability afterwards.
Yeah.
And what was really refreshing as well, and from hearing you talk about the process of writing it, is that I know that some poets sit down with a very rigid theme in mind and they're like, you know, right, I'm going to write 20 poems on this theme. In this style, and I love hearing that you've kind of, you know, set fire to that piece of advice and you're like, no, I just it was created, it was born, it was organic.
I mean, yeah, for me, I have so much respect for the poets who do that. Mm. Because I can't. I tried to be a write everyday poet. I tried to be a form poet. So I went to university in Norwich. Mm-hmm. And there was a poet there, and I cannot for the life of me remember their name. But they used to do 28 sonnets later, where in the month of February, they would write 28 sonnets.
Good for them.
And I tried, forgetting that, and much I love reading sonnets, I hate writing them, and I'm crap at them. after about day three, I came within a hair's breadth of setting fire to my notebook. So I just kind of decided that, you know what, me and Form are going to have a open relationship at best.
That's amazing.
And I will do what comes naturally, and I'll do what makes sense. And then I will edit and edit and edit until the cows come home.
Yeah.
So that will make sense to somebody who's not me.
That's brilliant. I think that's a fantastic way of doing it. I mean, yeah, I think when it comes to writing novels, you'd be called a pantser rather than a plotter.
Oh, 100%.
I love that. And so you put your art out across various mediums, many mediums. You've got poetry, spoken word, plays, audio dramas, essays. Do you have a favourite medium? Is there anything that allows you to satisfy one bit of creative expression but not another?
I guess in my heart of hearts, I'm a poet. Mm-hmm. That was my first form that I came to when I was like all of 7 years old.
Wow.
And it's the one that I return to the most frequently.
Mm.
The only thing is with poetry is that it is astonishingly difficult to make a living as a poet. And also there are some narratives that I want to explore, some stories that I want to tell, but I cannot do in a poem.
Yeah.
And so with Mirror Mirror, writing an audio drama, that was a first for me.
Mm.
And I had, you know, through New Creative North, we had editing and we had mentorship and a lot of support, because I had no idea what I was doing. I must have gone through about 40 drafts with my mentors, who, bless them, were very patient with me. They had told me over and over and over again that a play has to have a plot. A play has to have a plot. And coming as a poet, where I write vibes first, I'm like, what's a plot? What's that? I don't... Can't just be vibes.
I love that.
Can't just be like some cool images. But I have a story, I have to have characters. Right, let's figure this out. And then I got to the end of it, and I realized that this is actually a really wonderful medium for conveying a narrative.
Yeah.
And for doing kind of, I can do things in scripts that I can't do in poems. And, you know, same with kind of when I do write essays, it's because I need to communicate something very clearly.
Mm.
And I need to do it in a way that we're kind of where every word in it, you know, has a very clear meaning. What I love about poetry is its ambiguity.
Yeah.
And it's this open to interpretation. But if I want to actually make an argument, then at that point I need to just write an essay.
And so having done my stalking, having read both your poetry and your essays, they're remarkably different, and obviously, you know, they're two very different styles of writing, so it's going to be different. But I thought to get that from one artist, to have such, as you say, beautifully open to interpretation, abstract, vibey poems, and then to read these essays, which are very direct, very clear. I mean, it was just wonderful, absolutely joyous to kind of get to look at all your different bits of work.
Thank you. No, this is really lovely. I think with the essays, I guess I write essays the way that I really, this last part, I write them the way that I speak, and then I will edit them and rework them so that they actually flow neatly from one point to another rather than jumping around. And then with essays, I write the way I speak. Whereas with poems, I tend, then at that point, I write the way I think. And, you know, there is a head of a filter process that goes from my brain to my mouth. Because I feel like my brain, I, at the risk of sounding horrendously pretentious, I do think in poetry. That is, you know, the metaphors and the images and the little snatches of phrases that's kind of swirling on my head all the time, and then I corral them into some kind of order so that I can speak out loud and actually make sense.
Yeah.
And then with essays, then have kind of an extra level of filtering, so that from speech it is coherent and linear and comprehensible enough to be on a page.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm still I'm still relatively new to script writing. But I think with that one, I'm enjoying the most with that is being able to explore character and relationships between characters in a way that, again, I can't in poetry and I definitely can't in essays.
Yeah, wow. So that's really interesting. Have you got any theatrical pieces in the pipeline?
So I sort of, yeah. I am currently writing a piece for a drama school for their third year drama students to do as part of their assessment.
Wow.
With me being me, it is a another very, very fey narrative. A mortal accidentally makes a fey bargain and so the fairy court moves into his flat.
That is brilliant. I'm in.
And so I'm working on that. I'm going to be going to the Arden School of Theatre for their final years. And I recently wrote a 30-ish minute short play that is based on the story of Clytemnestra and Electra from the Oresteia by Aeschylus. Because I'm a little bit obsessed with the Greeks right now.
And, aren't all poets a little bit obsessed with Greeks?
You know, it comes with the territory.
Yeah.
And yeah, so obviously, you know, Electra helped her brother Orestes kill their mother, Clytemnestra. And in this play called Two Coins, Clytemnestra is waiting by the Styx for Electra because Clytemnestra wants to bury the hatchet. She wants them to be a family again. She wants them to move on. You know, they're dead, it shouldn't matter. But Electra is still furious and bitter and resentful of her mother. And really, for me, it's the question of, you know, why would a daughter kill her mother? What would push a young woman to side with her absentee warmongering father over her mother? And so I wanted to kind of explore that relationship. So we have Two Coins and I have a list of plays I want to write the length of my arm for the trick or just for finding the time to get to them all.
Well, exactly.
Because now that I am working in theatre, I love it. I really, really love it.
That's fantastic. And those students that get to do the other play that you're writing, I think, I mean, they're just so incredibly lucky. So on the fantasy front, before we move on and before I forget, do you have classic cheesy fantasy that are, you know, your absolute favorite? Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. No, the reason I sigh is that I know exactly what it is and I'm slightly ashamed of myself. So there is a novel called Polgara the Sorceress by a man called Dave Eddings. And Dave Eddings was a horrendous human being in his lifetime. You know, if I didn't get his book secondhand, I wouldn't buy them at all because he was just truly horrendous in so many ways. But Polgara the Sorceress is a fantasy novel about a woman called Polgara, shockingly, that is a sorceress, of course, but she is the most beautiful and perfect and magical and wonderful woman who ever existed. She is amazing at everything. She has basically no character flaws and she goes around saving the world. It is unbearably cheesy.
It sounds great.
It is not fantastically well written. The world building is sketchy at best, but it's so much fun.
It sounds it. Wow. So that's your favorite. Absolutely wonderful. I mean, who doesn't want a little bit of cheesy fantasy in their life every now and then?
Yeah, so, you know, I love, you know, beautifully written, rich and detailed. I love Anke Jemisin. Yes. I love Kujale Clark. And, you know, I love Nolan Hopkins and all that. I think the sheer level of artistry you see in so much speculative fiction is just gorgeous. But sometimes I want the literary equivalent of the Greggs. And when I want a book that is also a Greggs, I go to Dave Eddings.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I don't know if Michael Moorcock kind of falls under the same category, but like I love a bit of Michael Moorcock.
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea that everything we read has to be, has have great literary value.
No.
Misunderstands the kind of that same way, kind of not everything we eat has to be beautifully cooked or wonderfully nutritious. You know, you can't have a Michelin starred meal every day. Sometimes you will want a giant bag of what's it?
Oh God, yes.
Or you'll want to have a like absolute carafe of milkshake. And the same goes for books. Sometimes you want the thing that will just make you feel good, even if it's not improving you as a person.
No, I completely agree. Agree more. I think it's so important to have those little comfort things, and we definitely shouldn't feel guilty or ashamed about consuming them.
No, I think I just wish that my comfort reads were still a little better than David.
I mean, no judgment, but it's very difficult. So how do you feel about separating art from the artist if the artist is, you know, fairly unpleasant in their behaviour or their thinking?
I mean, I am also something of a fan of the work of H.P. Lovecraft. Yeah. So I have thought about this quite a lot.
Yeah.
And the way I think the framework that I've developed is what I have dubbed myself Take Me Out, where you can't really separate art from the artist.
Yeah.
And the art comes from the artist. And inevitably, like literally inevitably, some of the art that you love will end up coming from bad people.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. You know, I really loved Firefly for a long time. And Joss Whedon is... Joss Whedon! You know, I love cosmic horror. I read the abridged Necronomicon in my teens. You know, I watch a lot of pulp, like the work of Frank Frazetta.
Mm.
Was like a fairly large part of again my adolescence and early 20s. So these are things that I really enjoy. The fact that I enjoy them, I don't think says anything about my moral character. Yeah. It's just that this thing that I love, the thing that I enjoy, comes from a bad person. And I think it's different if that person's continuing to profit from their work.
Yeah.
So for example, if I was going to rewatch Firefly, I'd pirate it. Yeah. If I wanted to reread Harry Potter, I would get it secondhand. Yeah. I wouldn't want to put more money in the pocket of these people. But just the fact that I may continue to enjoy that work is just comes from being a person who consumes media.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have my red lines and I have my things that I just won't engage with and things I just won't watch or read or listen to. But yeah, you know, I like H.P. Lovecraft and I love ballet. And, you know, I grew up on Carry On.
Yes.
And yeah, you know, and the kind of Carry On campaign is horrendous. It's really terrible.
It's so terrible. But it's so terrible. But I loved it. And I also grew up, TV.
Yeah.
At that age was misogynistic and terrible in so many different ways.
Yeah, I think they just kind of hit every bigotry they could.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I think it take the loss.
Yeah.
Except that the media you love comes from people, and some people are dickheads. And do your best not to put more money into the pocket of dickheads. But if you do sometimes, then that's life,
yeah.
Unfortunately.
I think the thing is with people like Joss Whedon, because Firefly is fucking excellent, and I'm still pissed that they cancelled it after one season. Because what were you thinking? Oh my god, you can see how brilliant it is. Like, what are you doing? And then Buffy as well. I think for a lot of us, it gave us a feminist role model. It gave us diversity. It showed me queer people on TV. I think for the first time, where they weren't being mocked or made fun of. And so to have, you know, all those positives almost erased by the person that has made it being an absolute arsehole, it is really difficult. But I think, as you say, don't promote it, don't put money into their pocket, but continue to enjoy it. And if it meant something to you, then by all means, you know, you have that as a resource for comfort, for enjoyment.
Yeah, and I think the thing, and also I suppose I find quite comforting, especially in something like Firefly. is knowing that, say, Twitter's for any artistic product that makes it out into the world. So for everything from the work of Hatefield Lovecraft, which you can say perhaps came from one mind, right through to something like Avengers Assemble, which has, you know, these massive teams of hundreds of people, but nothing ever truly comes from one person. So for HP Lovecraft, how much of it was him, how much of it was the editors that he worked with, the writing group he was a part of. For something like Firefly, you know, how much of it was Joss Whedon, how much of it was the rest of the writer's room, the directors, assistant directors, everyone from the runner to the makeup artist, all were all part of this process. And so, yeah, you know, I don't try to separate the art from the artist. I don't think it's possible. The art came from the artist. The art is a part of the artist. But one, for almost everything, there are many artists. But also, let's say that, in the case of Hayden Lovecraft, probably safely say that him and everyone that he worked with and everyone he associated with was a horrendous racist.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, he's dead. He's extremely dead.
Yeah.
And
not sad. Like,
and the genre that he helped to birth is still going strong and is doing so much. And so I can enjoy it without necessarily condoning him as a person.
Yeah.
And I can enjoy it without it necessarily reflecting on my character. Now, if I was like, because I love H.P. Lovecraft's work, I therefore love him as a person, he was great. At that point, I'm a dickhead.
Yeah.
At that point, I am entirely off base. I say that, you know, I enjoy Firefly, therefore Josh Whedon is a good person. Mm. That is a losing battle.
Yeah.
But multiple things can be true at once. I can really like, you know, the Necronomicon and Hatefield Lovecraft, the horrendous racist.
Yeah.
I can really enjoy Firefly and Josh Whedon is misogynist and racist and an abusive boss. And those things can all be true.
Yeah, and I think it's looking at the point behind, you know, when you get a lot of people calling for cancellation of a writer, of an artist. And I think, well, actually, let's look at the point. And as you say, you're not funding their life. You're not giving them any money. You're not giving them personally any energy. But actually what they've created means something to you. Or, I mean, Harry Potter, for a lot of people, because we are talking about a lot of historical things where the artists are dead. But I thought, well, and Joss Whedon, but if we bring it to J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter meant a lot to a lot of trans people as well. And I think probably it's a very difficult question, but there are still people who will read Harry Potter, who will buy secondhand copies, who will pirate the films, which, yes, I'm not condoning it, but totally pirate them, but not put any money towards that horrendous woman, you know, because that's the point, isn't it? You're not supporting her as a person. You are enjoying consuming the art.
Yes, and I think that is that's the distinction. And then also part of the my take the owl philosophy also means that, you know what, some people may well, even quite rightly, take umbrage with the fact that you enjoy this thing. It doesn't mean you have to stop, but it is true. And so, you know, for my weakness for 70s and 80s pulp, you know, those Conan and that lot, yeah, they are deeply misogynistic. Yeah, they are horrendously racist. You know, my weakness for Independence Day, the absolute crop of American imperial propaganda that it is. Yeah. If somebody took umbrage with that, and you know what, if I was vocal about how much I enjoy Independence Day and the first Transformers film and Fast and Furious and that, you know, genre of American imperial propaganda film,
yeah,
and somebody took that and had questions about my politics and my stance on things, I think that would be fair and reasonable.
Yeah.
And then at that point, it becomes up to me whether I engage or not, whether I defend myself or not.
Yeah.
But if I'm out here saying that, you know, my Hatefield Lovecraft is one of my favourite writers, I mean, he's not, but to say that he is. Yeah. And then someone was questioning, am I hella racist. That'll be a fair question to ask. Yeah. And it'll be up to me to answer it or not, depending on whether or not I wanted to engage. I think that's the thing. It's literally take the loss.
Yeah.
Because not everything's going to be a winner. And with that, and then on that vein, it means extending the same grace to other people that you would hope they extend to you. Because, you know what, we will all have things that we love that do not align with our politics, or like who are made by creators who don't share our politics. And so I think it is that balance between when someone shows you who they are, believe them, but also that we are full of contradictions ourselves as people.
Absolutely. We're human, and we've got these little things that we're very attached to. I'd say I feel extremely uncomfortable watching some things from kind of like anywhere between kind of like the 40s up until a few years ago, where it's, you know, overtly misogynistic, racist, homophobic. But there are things that I still enjoy, like as you were saying, kind of Independence Day or those really disgracefully cheesy action films, which are just so wrong, and there's objectification of women, but also I love them. But by the same token, I'm not going to go and put my, for instance, like my Harry Potter house in my bio, because I've listened to what people need and what people are saying. And actually, it's like, actually, by doing that, you're not communicating your love for Harry Potter. You're showing support for somebody who has injured a lot of people in the community. And so I think there's an awareness that we need to have by not promoting our love for offensive things. But also, it comes down to do what you want to do in the comfort of your own home, but try not to hurt anyone, I suppose.
Yeah, and the thing is, the thing, and also, being aware of the subtext of what it is you're communicating.
Yeah.
And that is inherently imperfect. You know, there are some things that they get wrong. So say somebody does have the Hogwarts house in their bio. If they are 35, it's probably worth asking some questions. If they're 13, leave them
be. Yeah, exactly.
Like, they're 13, it's literally not that big a deal. But also kind of, you know, maybe Harry Potter or whatever is really cool to you, to your understanding of yourself. And you want to communicate that this piece of media has been so formative for you. Is that point also questioning, okay, but what else could you implicitly be communicating and managing that, especially in a forum like Twitter that is so open and so public? And it is just that it's that negotiation, and it's one that is ongoing, and yet is constantly shifting and is inherently imperfect. But all we can do is try, and all we can do is try, fail, try again, fail better.
And I think it's important to not pile on people if they make a mistake, but actually I think if you bring it to someone's awareness and they still kind of steadfastly hold on to their toxic viewpoints, or they react very negatively and very defensively, then that's one thing. But I think if you give someone space and say, hey, actually, do you realize that what you're doing or what you're saying is condoning this person's behavior who's been very harmful, I think that's different.
And the first thing, you know, it is that, again, communicating in a public sphere is difficult. And so, you know, if you are a trans person who has been dealing with the Rowling bullshit for years and years now, seeing another hashtag Gryffindor in a bio, is not anything that's reasonable to expect somebody to have limitless patience and limitless grace. That's not a fair thing to ask of somebody.
No.
And at the same time, you know, for somebody who literally just doesn't know or who is unaware, having somebody come at you very aggressively is really difficult, and it, you know, can trigger you know, literally trigger fight or flight responses.
Yes.
And so it is about trying to manage all of those competing emotional needs. And also at the core of it is about trying to achieve justice, trying to find justice and achieve justice. And what that looks like is constantly shifting.
Yeah.
And what that sounds like is constantly shifting. And say in that particular interaction, I would put in the trans person's emotional needs at that point for me would come first.
Yeah.
Because they're the one experiencing the systemic violence in this situation. But also I would question if, say, in the case of Harry Potter house in Bayern, if there's not somebody that you know, somebody that you interact with on a regular basis, somebody with whom you've had previous conversations, would you be the best person to communicate this to that person? And also, would it even be better for you to just mute or block and move on?
Yeah.
Mute or block and move on rather than engaging. And again, that is something that will be very situational, depending on the person. I'm not trying to tell people how to handle these microaggressions and these many, many layers of communication that exist online, often with very little clarity as to somebody's intentions or somebody's politics, or whatever it may be. But yeah, just trying to figure out kind of what is the best thing for you to preserve your peace and preserve what joy you have.
Yeah.
And also what it is you hope to achieve by communicating. And if what you hope to achieve for yourself is catharsis.
Yeah.
Just remembering that there is somebody else on the other side of that screen, have your catharsis.
Yeah.
But if you are trying to get somebody to change their mind, know that that is a very difficult thing to do. And yeah, it's just so complicated, and I think it's an ongoing issue, an ongoing conversation that I do not necessarily have. I definitely don't have all of the answers for.
Mm.
I just know how I try to manage it within my online space.
Yeah. And as you say,
and I am very much of the mute, block, move on, and get on with my day, because I can't fight every battle. Most battles, because I have very little emotional energy. I'm quite an anxious person. I just wouldn't do me any good.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously during the pandemic, we've had 2 years of a lot of prejudice kind of being aired, mostly online, and I feel like it's intensified in terms of pressure and toxicity. And I've seen quite a lot of ableist comments as well. And the temptation to try and engage with every person you see and try and explain why your existence is worthwhile and why you don't want to die. The temptation is there. And then it's been this wonderful masterclass of learning to just mute, block, move on. Because you can't spend your life doing that. But
no, you know, there are some people where their calling in life, or the work they choose to take on, how you want to say it, is education, is reaching people and providing resources and trying to educate people and the people who want to learn, bringing them in.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have so much admiration and respect for those people, because that is often a thankless task. But I think part of that is also knowing, you know, who can you reasonably reach?
Yeah.
And how can you reach them? And, you know, is dropping into somebody's mentions unprovoked the best way to reach them? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Mm. And it's about trying to strike the balance. And for me, knowing that what I want for my online experience most of the time is a diversion, a place to just kind of dump my thoughts when they're relatively unfinished.
Yeah.
And somewhere to connect with people that I wouldn't necessarily get a chance to speak to otherwise.
And it's been wonderful for that, for breeding a sense of community when we've not been face to face, which is great.
Yeah, for sure. And that's the thing. So fighting on Twitter is not my calling and it's not my ministry and it's not my lot in life.
Yeah, please continue to put your energy towards making great works of art instead.
I wanted to take all that energy and put it into my writing, put it into my performance and into my friends and knitting and my cat. and not spend it on people who I fundamentally don't actually care about very much.
Yeah.
You know, first name, bunch of numbers. I don't care about them.
Gary, five, six,
they're not my, random handles of people that I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't care about
them.
It's
not worth it.
And so I then don't have any reason to engage with them.
Yeah.
And that is how I manage my online space. Mm. But yeah, different strokes, different folks.
Indeed. I went down a hole which I hadn't expected to go down. And who knows, might cut all of that because it was interesting, definitely separating the art from the artist. And then I don't know what happened. I'm very sorry. I think my brain switched off, but my mouth continued, which is liable to happen. So one of the things that you put on the podcast questionnaire was that you wanted to discuss how you are a politically aware artist who is not necessarily an activist, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, it's one thing that kind of I think about every now and then, because I mean this happens very occasionally, but every now and then somebody will describe me as an activist, and most of the time I'll correct them and be like, actually I'm not. because I don't, I know and I have known activists.
Mm.
And the time and the effort and the energy that they put into their work.
Yeah.
The way that they fight for positive change, whatever they do that. I don't do that fundamentally. I make art about what I want to make it about. Sometimes it's political. I mean, it's all inherently political, but sometimes it is deliberately, consciously political.
Mm.
Oftentimes it's not. On my Twitter, I will talk about, fatness and blackness and queerness politically. Most of the time, I just like and retweet. I might write the occasional essay.
Mm.
But I think for me, I don't do the kind of sustained work of activism. I don't do anything with necessarily with much of a goal in mind, other than this needs to get out of my head.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I am very, I try to be very politically aware, and fat politics and black politics and queer politics and socialist and anarchist politics are all things that I am very cognizant of.
Yep.
And things that I try to, things that, I use to inform the way I live my life and the way that I treat people. And that is to say that then it will make it into my art. So in many ways, kind of the body in its seasons is a treatise against social climbing. And, that climbing capitalist ladder is not worth it.
Yeah.
And my solo show is about queer love in all the ways that it manifests itself.
Mm.
So my work is politically informed because I am politically informed.
Yeah.
But I don't want my work to be placed alongside activism because it's not what I do. But also I do not want to then co-opt and in doing so devalue the labour and the work of activists and organisers and the people who make sacrifices big and small for the sake of a better world. I hope one day I'll be that person, but I'm not that person right now. Right now, I'm just a person who overthinks, and then that overthinking spills itself out into art and into overlong, overly involved Twitter threads.
Which is one. So I've got some thoughts on this because I got called an activist by a journalist when I was interviewed for an article in the Financial Times. So there is genuinely a picture of me in the Financial Times with a description saying that I'm a writer and activist, which makes me extremely uncomfortable for the reasons that you gave, but like also a little bit proud. But then the shame comes back and I'm like, oh God, no, if I really was, then I should be doing a lot more. But by definition, an activist is a person who campaigns to bring about societal change, which does sound a lot like the role of an artist, particularly your work, because it's steeped in political awareness and filled with commentary about race, gender, class, body image. And you even said, I'm going to lift your own words from an essay, poetry can slip into politics when you're not looking. The stories poets choose to tell and how we choose to tell them says a lot about our social and political outlook. So, yeah, an artivist, is that maybe a better term?
Maybe. But even then, you know, again, I know artist activists and I know people who very consciously do the work of arts-based activism.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think perhaps because when I write, I don't do it seeking to bring about social change. It is, for me, a very selfish process. It is about taking what's living in my brain, what I can't stop obsessing about, and getting it out so that it frees up space for me to think about anything else.
Do you think it's a question of intentionality?
Yeah, I think it's a question of intention and of being deliberate in what you do. Whilst I am deliberate and I am careful in the art that I put out into the world. So I'm a very iterative writer. I'll go through dozens and dozens of drafts before I arrive at a version that I'm happy with. I'm happy to be seen publicly.
Yeah.
But when it comes to deciding what it is I'm making and what it is I'm doing, I go vibe first. I go vibe first, or very occasionally story or character first. Mm-hmm. And then the politics just emerges as I figure out the best way to say whatever it is I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And then it goes out into the world. And because, you know, politics and social politics is almost like an intellectual pet project, I suppose, of mine, something that I've been interested in since I was relatively young. And because I try to be a good person who treats people well and is aware of the world in which I live, it is inevitable that that will then end up in my writing and in my performance and just in the stuff that I make. But I don't have any specific, I don't have a political goal in mind when I write, or even a political agenda in mind when I write. It's just my brain spilling out.
Which is so interesting, because I have no doubt that anyone that reads, I mean, literally anything you've written ever, but your essays in particular, if they read them and they didn't find them persuasive to a certain political leaning, I would be very surprised. You've written about fat phobia, style, being black, biphobia, and how you style yourself in a way that lets people assume you pose no threat to their social order and spares you some violence in the process, which I think is just so, I mean, that's so powerful. And that whole essay, a couple of other essays that I read, I think when people read those, there's no doubt as to what is right and what is wrong with society.
Thank you. I mean, with that essay in particular, again, not something that I needed to write because I was recalibrating my relationship with my wardrobe because of lockdowns and because of being inside all the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was thinking a lot about the way that I move through the world and knowing that a lot of what I do is about, a lot of the way that my character has formed is unfortunately about avoiding violence and benefiting from the privileges that I do have. And for me, it is the moral complexity of that trade-off. You know, knowing that part of the reason why I'm able to do what I do is because I sound the way I do and I carry myself in the way that I do, and I come from the class background that I come from, you know, so like classic middle class immigrant stories, in a lot of ways. And at the same time, I know that being fat, being black, and over the past year or two, being increasingly visibly queer comes with its own shit, to put it bluntly. I was trying to think of a delicate thing, but it comes with its own shit. The way that I dress is how I can mediate that process to the best of my ability. And so for me, it was thinking about that, and then also being aware that there are people who do not get to make that choice because they do not have access to the resources that I have, material, social, and otherwise. And so again, one of the things was like trying to get this thing out of my head onto a page, and the politics emerges as I write rather than being the point of the play.
Right, I could continue quoting lines from your essay like all evening. Can I just do one more? Can I just? I fully accept that your work isn't written.
I mean, I will not say no. It is your podcast.
it's just a Maz Hedgehog like fan cast at this stage. Sorry, I love you. But okay. So I've got two, and that's it. I promise I'm done. You said, my perception of myself may always be filtered through this deeply anti-black, biphobic and fatphobic society, but I can continue to fight for a sense of self built more around freedom than acquiescence. It's just so rich and so clear and so vibrant, and I love that. You've also said, so much of my livelihood depends on making thin white people comfortable. Now, that whole essay was about perception of self, about how style is, okay, this is the last quote, style is, after all, a kind of speech, incomplete, imprecise and beautiful. And your style, your fashion, how you present yourself seems to be yet another facet, another outpouring of your art. It just seems to be another medium.
It is.
Okay, there you go.
It's a joke, but not a joke, that I say that in lots of ways my wardrobe is my greatest achievement. I'm looking at it now as I talk, and I love it. I love it so much. You know, every piece that I have in there has been carefully chosen and curated. And, you know, it's a vision where I can close my eyes, pick two things at random, and they'll look, and they may not look perfect together, but I could walk out the house and them and not be embarrassed.
Wow.
And that is a process of several years of careful selection and curation and pruning occasionally, so that I can walk out of my house communicating what I want to, and not what I want to communicate with my style and my wardrobe, is that I appreciate beauty and I like things that look nice, and occupying beauty as something that in a lot of ways I have been taught is not mine to claim. It's something that I can claim for myself, and whether or not other people see it or whether or not other people appreciate it, it is mine. And I'm not a visual artist in any other way except for with my wardrobe. My wardrobe is my visual art. And something I think that kind of in a different life, a different universe, I may have ended up working in fashion. But the fashion industry, again, not my portion, not my calling. but I just think that I love seeing what other people are wearing and observing what other people are wearing and learning a little bit about them. In seeing how they have dressed themselves.
Oh my god, dear listener, I greeted Maz this evening to record this podcast wearing not one but two fleeces, some fingerless gloves and a hat. So please, how are you judging me?
I mean, I said you look cozy. You look incredibly comfortable and very cozy. And the thing is, you know, I dress aesthetic first.
Yeah,
aesthetic first, comfort second, practicality first.
Oh my god, no. I'm mostly practicality first, I have to say. But I wish so much that I could do what you do, which is You look incredibly well put together every time you're snapped on a camera. It's outstanding. So well done.
Thank you.
I personally don't have the resources for that time, but also I'm clumsy as fuck. So a lot of my good clothes end up with rips in them or buttons missing.
And yet, I think kind of for me, fashion is important to me, but it's not as important to me. Again, I know that I'm able to do this because I have the resources to.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't got masses and masses and masses of money, but I do have a decent job and I do have energy and I have storage space.
Yeah.
And I have relatively secure housing. And whilst I am fat, I'm a size 20 to 24. So that means that most plus size ranges include me. Mm. If I was size 28 or size 30 or more, then it would be infinitely more difficult for me to engage with the fashion way that I do.
Yeah.
If I have mobility issues, it would be difficult. If I had problems with my fine motor control,
yeah,
then that would be more difficult. If I had less money.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's about knowing that this is a thing that I love, but I'm able to engage with it,
yeah,
because of the resources that I have access to that other people don't.
Yeah, it is about that perfect cocktail, as you say. I was having this chat with three other disabled people, actually, both on separate podcasts that I was being interviewed on, which was, it was weird that they picked up on my style because I think I don't have any. But we were talking about fashion and what we wear and how we can't always communicate our personalities through our style, because for many of us, buttons are hard. I have to be having a very good fine motor skill day to wear a shirt with buttons, or trousers with lots of buttons on, or not be so bloated that I can wear some tailored trousers. But it is a joy to see what you're wearing every time I see you.
Thank you. And I think the one that I would love to see is more adaptive clothing.
Yes, please.
Kind of, because especially when buttons a lot of time are mostly aesthetic.
Mm.
I mean, obviously there are reasons why, but it should be from quite easy to find buttons that are actually just like the push pop things.
Yeah.
Even magnets to make putting a button up shirt much easier. Having trousers that fall like they're tailored, but have enough stretch,
yeah,
to make room for bloat. And so stuff like that should be more accessible, but we live in a deeply inaccessible society,
yeah,
from the ground up. And the fashion industry is terrible, yeah, for it.
We're starting to see a lot more really attractive, very stylish disabled influencers. And so I think they're going to encourage a push in the fashion industry to have more accessible clothing, which I am here for, but I probably will still dress like I do. There's one line that mentions fashion that I wanted to mention because it tackles the patriarchy and feminism and fashion. And I just think it's so excellent. And you, going back to what you were saying earlier, that genre means that you can get such a vast bit of world building across, or a vast theme across, in such a small space, or in so few words. I think this is a really great example of that. You say the women here don't mind, they wear fine cotton and scoop sugar and talk about which men rule them best. And I was like, fuck, that's, you know, like a line in a bit, and you've set so much in there.
Yeah, that is in eggshells, I believe. Yeah, you know, I was interested in fashion history, like 19th century fashion history, for about one summer in my preteens. And so I read a lot when I was like 12. And, you know, I think for me, the thing that soured a lot of the pretty dresses of that era, and of the 18th and 17th century and the like, is knowing where they came from, and knowing that these beautiful, like the beautiful, yep, Georgian muslin gowns, that cotton muslin, were slave cotton.
Yeah.
And knowing that the cups of tea that they'd be drinking and the cup of coffee that they'd have in these very stylish coffee houses.
Yeah.
The coffee and the sugar was probably grown by slaves, and the, yep, tea was grown by people who were indentured servants at best. And so for the wonderful heroines of those Georgian novels, both written in the contemporary, written at the time, and written today, and everything in between, and to a degree, you know, the heroines of now, you know, I am sat in clothing that was probably sewn by somebody who was making pennies, you know, using fabric that was, you know, either derived from, yeah, plastic, or was grown by somebody making pennies. And what that says about power,
yeah,
and what that means for ethics. And yeah, as pretty as those ladies are, as lovely as the Elizabeth Bennets of the world are, they are, their that comfort and that wealth, mine included, is built on a great deal of injustice and is built on a great deal of blood. And for me, that's kind of what Eggshells is about, the human cost of comfort.
Honestly, I think those two lines are the best example that anyone could ever ask for a piece communicating in a very short space of time. So much history, so much background, so much sense of injustice. Is it also in Eggshells where you've got the line, "She is silent, waiting for it to end"? Is it that Eggshells?
Yeah, that's in Eggshells as well.
Okay, so if you're willing to, if we can quickly touch on this. So I am someone who experiences sometimes very severe PTSD with regards to sexual assault. So this line, when I read it, "She is silent, waiting for it to end. She is too young to realise it will never end. She will carry his tongue like a brand." I mean, it's just absolutely spot on. And I had this moment where I kind of, something inside cracked open and I cried and I was like, this is exactly what it feels like. That's exactly a perfect way to encapsulate what PTSD feels like.
Yeah, for me, I am unfortunately also a survivor of sexual assault many times over, sadly. I think much the same way that anatomy is about the process of loving yourself through. Kind of what I wanted to do with that moment in Eggshells is kind of that once that has been done, there is no going back. Once that has been taken from you, there is no going back. There is no going back to the person that you were before. There is no moment when it ends and you're fine and it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
That experience is one that fundamentally changes you.
Yeah.
And what, if for me, in my mind, what happens to that young woman is that, one, she kills a rapist, and I'm in general very pro that.
Yeah.
But also kind of, it is the process of, for her, for that girl, for that young woman, move when she rebuilds herself and rebuilds herself around the knot of scar tissue that will leave, is that even carrying his tongue like a brand, even knowing that this thing will live inside you the rest of your life, there will be a rest of your life. And the rest of your life can be a good one, and it can be a happy one. And it can be one filled with joy and love. And even when it feels like that has taken away your ability to experience intimacy and experience love and experience affection, even if touch is never the same again, there are so many other ways that love and intimacy and affection can happen. And they can all be fulfilling. And they can all be warming. And they can all be deeply meaningful.
Yeah.
And even though Eggshells leaves that young woman there, for me, I had to know in myself that, yeah, she goes on and she is happy and she is well. And it takes a long time, but she gets there.
Yeah.
And kind of it takes Maddie a long time, but she gets there.
Yeah. And I think that's a message that you communicate really strongly. And I think that's so powerful for many of us to reach, because as much as this collection explores, it's like a quest for beauty and the divine and an exploration of self, but it acknowledges the painfulness of the human condition and trauma, and then says, but also it's probably going to be okay in the end.
Yeah, that's what I want. And also that it'll be okay once you step outside yourself a little bit and get out of your own head a little bit. Because me, I love my own company. I can quite happily spend days and days and days not speaking to anybody.
Yeah.
But I know that I need people.
Yeah, no manners at all.
Yeah. And that in needing people and other people needing us, that's where joy happens.
Yeah, connection.
Yeah.
Belonging. Yeah. I'm going to stop asking you questions in a minute, but I will say, because I'm so excited and I'm like absolutely obsessed with this collection, the second half, so the line that I just quoted and that we had that wonderful discussion about, the line immediately after that is, "But this man, this well-bred young man whose fathers gave him more stolen land than he could walk in a lifetime, has decided to take again." And I just want to grab you and scream at you, because you put this profound amount of context again into such a short space in a book. And it's so joyful to read. And I think I could probably do this on every page. So I'm going to stop talking now. Oh god, yeah, you've absolutely ruined me, Maz, thank you. So do you have something that you'd like to share with us? Do you want to give us an excerpt from The Body in its seasons? Now I've raved about it.
Yes. So I think, seeing as this is The Body in its seasons, I will read from The Body to give a little taste of what this, or kind of the vibe for the whole thing. And also, this is the one that has no footnotes, so I've got to figure out how to read footnotes. So this is The Body. As we told by Madeline Ecclesia for A Room of No Longer Strangers, there were details missing and misunderstood, and their hands shook all the while. That said, they told the story clearly, with a passion born of an obsession remembered. This is The Body. Well made, imperfectly formed. It is wet earth and a rain-soaked night. The body has slotted gold and the sparkle of land on the horizon between its ribs for the first man who comes looking for home. The body has attracted many men, inflamed a lust in them so rich and full they become something more than just men, or less than just men, or made half ravenous and half ocean and not exactly pitiful. Adam was not the first, but he was the first the body saw fit to remember. Adam was the colour of wet sand, soft as the body. He wanted to please the body, but the body is not to be pleased. He pushed until it reached into its gullet and pulled out offal and cream. Adam denied that he hungered, but the gifts of the body were so thick and so rich, and his wounds ran so deep that he gorged himself. Adam took what was given and then reached into the body for more and more, until fig wasps and unripe grapes poured from his mouth. He was not angry at the body. He was disgusted that he should desire such a bounty, that his hard-earned wisdom and the unspoken, barely spoken, freely spoken judgment of other men had not inured him to the body. He thought to cure his gluttony with a life spent in the cold. He took the body with him. The result was the same. Adam ploughed the body into the earth, seeded date orchards in its mouth. Adam denied himself satiety, took only the most meagre of meals, all sugar and bone. He gnawed at them until he broke his teeth on the body. He was the first that the body left. It is not suited to cold. Benjamin was too small. He saw his brother have the body, carry its sweat and lipstick and the humming electricity of its tongue on his skin. The body did not like Benjamin's brother, but he served its purpose, and that is enough sometimes. Benjamin saw the streak of mud on his brother's cheek, left by the body's hands, and Benjamin burned hotter than the desert sun. His eyes willed the star/body to fall at his feet so he might walk on fired earth. When the stars did not obey, and his brother did not relinquish the body, Benjamin had dreams salty as a sea untamed, and his rage was untamed, and Benjamin threw his brother into a pit, or sold him to slavers, or tore out his spine and used the vertebrae as missiles to knock the stars out of the sky, and Benjamin vowed to use the body until he was satisfied. The body did not reach into itself because Benjamin stretched his hand past wine dark flesh and ordered dates for something pure and heady. Benjamin knew the body would be pure and heady if he could reach far enough. Benjamin's arms were too small. Benjamin left hungry, licking blood and water and honey from his arms. It was not honey. It was not water. Benjamin died a small man. Benjamin's brother did not die. Benjamin's brother could have told him how to use the body. Brothers know these things. Emmanuel was good. Emmanuel nestled deep within the body, sharp shoulders and fetal innocence. He hid inside after taller, whiter, richer men taught him how little the kinship of maleness meant when you had emerged from the wrong womb or on the wrong side of the wrong ocean or mountain or town. He murmured, whispered split skin and torn muscle secrets about these first wounds. He told the body that family is the first wound. The body told him that there are always others. A constellation of life that was almost lived or should not have been lived. Emmanuel watched the men burn down the orchards he would call his own. He saw them cast razor wire nets into the lake to stop those who would fish it. He saw rain swollen earth and stones roll down the mountainside by the ton burying fertile ground and the men who ploughed it. He did not see the others. Their hunger, their bodies, their terror did not move him. The body understood. Benjamin is good, but he is limited. He watched, tucked up in the recesses of the body, his hair tickling its nose. The body protected Emmanuel from the fire and the bloody water, stones. The body fed him on quail and honey and the other things men could not reach. The body showed him some of its constellations, how he may heal his own. But Emmanuel loved the body. He even thanked the body when his hand stopped bleeding and his ribs re-knit over the soft delicacy of his breath. The body would not have been so surprised when Emmanuel walked away, untouched by desert heat and ocean spray. It has not seen Emmanuel since the final stone rolled away. It has heard that another body drew him into the sky, born on light brighter than any natural thing could produce. The body tried not to mourn the loss. The body tried not to love this one. The body failed. There were more. There are always more men submerged in desire, so all-consuming the body is all-consumed. The body is infinite. The body has made itself infinite. The body does not hunger, it refuses thirst. The body is for these men. The body is well made, imperfectly formed. The body reslots gold between its ribs because of an outer horizon. Another wound touches the body. His name is Paul.
Oh my God, hearing you read it is even better than reading it.
Thank you.
And then I was Thank reading you. Along with my coffee, and so I've got all the footnotes as well that are there, or the little modifiers to the body.
Yes. Other thing, you know, with this collection being as experimental as it is, yeah, they'll kind of have a lot of footnotes and asides and modifiers and little bits and pieces, kind of trying to find ways to add context without writing pieces that are 800 pages long in of themselves. Yeah,
absolutely incredible. Some of the lines in there as well, I could wax lyrical about. It's as I said, must have been a couple of hours ago now. that first piece really grabs the reader by the hands and drags them in. It's such a strong opening.
Thank you. Yeah. Like I said, it is the moment I wrote it, I knew that it had to be the centerpiece of the collection and I could get the opening salvo so that people know what they're getting in for. I figured that if you enjoy the body, you will enjoy the rest of the collection. Yeah. And if it's not your jam, then this book is not your jam.
That's very kind of you to give us that. Maz, I am gonna let you go because I cannot believe it's been almost 2 hours that we've been talking.
Oh my goodness, has it? I mean, I've been having a great time. I completely lost track of time there.
That's fantastic. Before you go, what mythical creature would you be and why?
Oh Christ, okay, that is a big question. To spring on a person.
I know, there you go.
Ooh, okay.
I feel like your answer is going to be particularly based on, I'm not going to build you up or anything, but I feel like it's going to be based on something really, really, like, you know, mythical and in some deep, intricate history of something, or not. Maybe it's not.
Oh, okay. So I think if I was going to be a mythical creature, what I would love to think of myself as would be one of the Vilis, that they are the spirits of wronged women who kill men. They feature in the ballet Giselle, where they try to kill Giselle's ancient boyfriend. And I think they're from like Central European mythology.
Mm.
Realistically, I am probably the little old witch in a cottage who is neither necessarily good nor evil.
Chaotic neutral.
Yeah, and not even the same kind of will. If you come to her, she might cause you problems. If you leave her alone, she'll leave you alone.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's two really quite different. Why do you say realistically you'd be the witch of the cottage?
Because I am quite a homebody. I am not sufficiently industrious to do murder. And And honestly, okay, to be the sad millennial in me, I figured the only way I'll actually ever be able to own a cottage of my own is if I'm literally a mythical creature.
Yeah, I mean, in today's economy, yeah. Okay, they are two fantastic answers. I'm going to take both of them. There's like the one that you would will yourself to be if you had the fucks, and the woman who gives no fucks, who lives in a cottage by herself. I love that. That's brilliant. Can I ask, was there a particular reason that both of those are female?
Because I grew up a girl. Mm-hmm. And politically, I generally identify with womanhood because of the way that I'm read in the world. And I've always been most drawn to stories about women. I mean, if there was a multiplicity of children's stories and fairy tales about non-binary people, then maybe that would be it. But given the choices that I had as a young growing up person, I always identified with womanness more than manness. And even now, I am universally read as a woman. And so those are the stories that resonate with me the most, I think.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much for giving me some insight into that. I get so curious about people's answers.
But no, yeah, I think it kind of is a really interesting question to ask. I think I was thinking throughout this whole interview, you've lobbed a lot of very interesting questions about me. I'm like, oh Christ, how am I going to answer that?
Oh my God, that, to be honest, that's really kind, because I think, you know, this could just be me fangirling, and I am going to gender that, because fanboying doesn't really have the same. But yeah, it could have just been 2 hours of me fangirling, to be honest. So I hope it has been interesting for you as well.
Yeah, I've had a great time. I'm still here two hours later.
Thank you.
You know, still got a great big smile on my face. So, you know, yeah, I've had a really good time.
that's brilliant. Maz, where can our listeners find you and follow you and catch up with your news?
So I am Maz Hedgehog on Twitter and on Instagram. I spend more time on Twitter than Instagram. A lot of my work is up on my website, mazhedgehog.com. I am also on Facebook, but I kind of never use it, so there's not really much point. And yeah, so I mean, the book comes out, the Body Unit Seasons comes out on the 15th of April, and you can pre-order it now from my website or from Burning Eye Books, or you can just follow me on Twitter and see what just weird ass thoughts spill out of my brain before I have to stop them.
Which is just fantastic. And if I'm correct, you are also performing at Rebel Riot Poetry on the 30th of May.
Yes,
I have booked you, right? Yeah, I've booked you.
yes, you have.
Oh my God. So yeah, that is going to be an absolutely phenomenal night. And to get to, are you going to do some The Body and Its Seasons for us there?
Yes, absolutely. And then I'll also bring a couple of the bits that are at this point uncollected. Because I haven't found the right home for them yet. It will be a lovely little mixed bag of a set.
Holy fuck. I'm literally so excited and I can't wait. I'm going to promote May as soon as the March launch, which is in a couple of weeks, as soon as that's out of the way. Oh my God. I can't believe people are going to get to see you perform for as little, it's like £3 or something a ticket. But yeah, so get your tickets now, listeners, get your tickets now. Maz, thank you so much. I am going to end this interview, and I still haven't found a really good way of like ending interviews.
Oh, sorry. Endings are always a bit awkward. But no, I've had the most fantastic time. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Until next time, stay curious.